It's now 12:09, and this is the Wintrust Business Lunch. We're produced by Pete Zimmerman. On Mondays, Elise Glink starts us off, the real estate and financial wellness expert. Her website is thinkglink.com. She wrote 100 questions every first-time home buyer should ask. Elise, thanks for joining us again on a Monday.
It's nice to be here, John.
Especially today. Dow's up now 624, and conversely, the NASDAQ is off 71. What are you reading about all of that?
Well, it's. I think people are very excited about the fact that the Senate has passed a version of stimulus that at least gives us the rough outlines of what it's going to look like when it's actually finished. It is going back to the House and then reconciliation, but there's progress.
And the things that aren't in there are maybe noteworthy, too. It's been debated whether or not there should be a minimum wage bill in there. There is not. It's not going to go up to $15 an hour as a result of this. Any comments from you on that?
You know, I think you can't boil the ocean. Let's focus on getting the help to people that they need. I thought that one of the things that did make it into the Senate version is making the first $10,200 of unemployment insurance income untaxable, which is terrific because you're not going to get people who have been hit already once this year and struggling. You're not going to get hit again by paying taxes on your unemployment. So that's actually kind of nice. And, you know, last year, just to remind everybody, 40 million Americans collected unemployment insurance benefits.
It's a common question we have here is, what do I have to pay taxes on? Stimulus, no, but we always said unemployment benefits, yes. So for your 2020, are we reading this the same way? For your 2020 unemployment benefits, the first $10,200 are not taxed?
That's what has been proposed and is part of that the Senate agreement. And so it wouldn't be the full amount of tax forgiveness, right? You'd still pay tax on some of it, but at least the first $10,200 would be forgiven. And I think that's not forgiven, but would not be taxed. And I think that's important to think about, and I hope that makes it through reconciliation so it actually gets signed into the bill.
And it would be 100% if you were below that threshold.
Correct.
The talk of forgiving student loan debt has kind of gone away. Evidently, the likes of an Elizabeth Warren and a Bernie Sanders want $50,000 of student debt forgiven. The president seemed to be amenable to $10,000, but he wasn't going to do it alone. I haven't heard the Congress talk much about student debt forgiveness in this bill. Have you?
Well, I think that it's at the $10,000 level. So, but it's just not as broad as it would have been. So the Senate Democrats did add that provision in, and which is great, and it would make about $10,000 forgivable for many borrowers. Of course, on the left, they're hoping that that means that more forgiveness, student debt forgiveness, would be coming down the pike. I don't know that that will happen. But I do think it's good that some of that student loan debt could get forgiven.
Yeah, Pete just handed this to me. So there are around 45 million student loan borrowers in the United States. A third of those are enrolled in income-driven repayment plans. Ray Kaplan talks about that all the time. These plans aim to make borrowers' payments more affordable by capping their monthly bills at a percentage of their discretionary income. And discretionary income is decided very favorably for you. It's not just how much do you have left over. It's a percent of a percent, and it's not that much money, meaning that a lot of folks don't have to pay as much as they would have otherwise. Anyway, at that point, their forgiven loans are treated as income, and the IRS sends the borrower a form called the 1099-C. Oh, that's interesting. That was part of the conversation previously, too. So if I get, say, $10,000 of forgiveness, then I have to pay 25, say you're in the 25% tax bracket, you'd pay 25% on that. You'd pay $2,500 then, right?
Correct. So this is all about phantom income. And we see this come up in other places in the tax code as well, where you get, if you get a gift from somebody, it actually is treated as income by the IRS, or it can be, depending on what it is. And so you then would have to pay tax on it. We see this a lot also with foreclosures. Like, so if you go into foreclosure, so you're already in terrible financial straits, and you have, let's say, a $100,000 mortgage, and the lender says, okay, we're going to just let that go, we're going to forgive it, and you think you're off the hook, the next year you're going to get a tax bill for $25,000 for the $100,000 mortgage that was forgiven. And a lot of people don't realize that that's how it is. And so you're really not off the hook. And I think what they're trying to do with student loans is figure out how they can actually forgive this and then also forgive the tax implications. I'd also like to point out that there are some forgiveness, student loan forgiveness programs that are already written into the Department of Education, where if you go to work as a police officer, a first responder, a teacher, and you meet certain requirements, that some or all of that student loan would get forgiven after a certain number of years of paying on it. And that program, which was in effect, basically got stymied over the last 4 years, and they stopped approving those forgiveness programs, and the Biden administration has started those up again.
If you make 120 consecutive payments and you're working in the public sector and you're enrolled in that program, after 10 straight years, you don't owe anything. If you're in the public sector, which is a lot of people, firefighters, public school teachers, doctors that work at nonprofit hospitals, et cetera, et cetera. Let's pause here. It's 12:15. We're talking to Elise Glink, real estate and financial wellness expert. I've got some real estate questions for you. I have a question about pricing of houses on the market and borrowing against that in just a minute. Elise Glink from Think Glink. You can find her stuff at thinkglink.com. She's the real estate and financial wellness expert. Joins us on Mondays at this time here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Okay, so at least we talked a little bit about the fact that the Dow is going up, the NASDAQ is going down. Some people see that as an interesting but not bad sign. We talked a little bit about student debt forgiveness. There's more devil in those details, and we'll get to them in a little bit. I had a real estate question for you. You're okay. Not, as much as you write about home buying, you're not a realtor, are you?
I am not. I'm not a realtor, although my mother was a realtor for about 35 years.
I wonder what you, or maybe I'll ask Amy Kite this too, think of the strategy. If say a house is going to sell for $300,000. The market is so hot right now, particularly in some areas, that people are getting, they'll put it on the market at $300,000, but they know that there's going to be a bidding war and that thing's going to sell for $330,000 or something like that. I wonder if people are intentionally putting their homes on the market at a price lower than they know they're going to get, so as to create that auction market, right? I mean, the people that are saying 300, you look at it and you go, oh, great. You know that thing is going to get multiple offers, and it's going to be over ask, which is great if you're a buyer. It's an interesting strategy. But I wonder if you, at the end of the day, you and the realtor know, in this market, that house is going to sell for 330, but you put it on the market at 300 and then let all of the energy from these buyers push it up to who knows what. You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. I would argue that that's definitely a strategy that works. It's working now, and there are a lot of people doing it. One way to counteract that as a buyer is to be even more aggressive. So I have seen offers made, and this, you're not always allowed to do this, but I've seen offers made that says basically, we will top any offer by X percent. That's their offer. So here's the offer. It's $310,000 on your $300,000 listing, but and you have 48 hours to accept or 24 hours to accept. If another offer comes in that's higher, we will automatically up our offer to top it by 5%.
Or $5,000 or something.
Correct.
Yeah, I've seen that too, just watching my son and some other people buy houses, and I've been watching the real estate market a little bit myself, and you see that, and you think that the buyers are so in the driver's seat. But I guess in that case, or the sellers are so in the driver's seat, but the buyer then needs to be willing to come in with a pretty substantial offer then, right?
Yeah, and they also have to worry that the property will appraise out in value, which is a problem if you're only putting down, let's say, 20%, and now the property goes up for an extra $25,000. You're going to have to increase the amount to maintain that 20% threshold for your loan requirement or take a different loan program. So there are other, you know, worries that the buyer would have about making that kind of open-ended offer. But the thing to do there is to really make sure that the seller is required to get back to you in a very short period of time, whether that's 12 hours or 24 hours or at the outside 48 hours.
Yeah, that's another point that Amy Kite was talking about with Hochberg on Saturday. And she said, you know, you want to get the appraiser you want to get, but you don't have the choice. The only one that matters is the home buyer's lender's appraiser. That guy's going to come in and tell the bank, hey, here's how much this house is really worth, which is funny to me because if people are willing to pay $330 for a house listed at $300, is that house a $300,000 house or is it a $330,000 house? It's a $330,000 house. Doesn't the market set the price?
So that's a great question, and we see this a lot, but the problem is in very hot markets, and you can think about this with, let's use a different analogy, right? GameStop. So the market, right? So the market drove GameStop up to something, you know, from something like maybe, say, $35 or $40 a share to $450 a share, or whatever crazy number that was, in 2 weeks. Do you think that GameStop, the company, was actually worth a tenfold increase in a 2 to 3 week period? Did they do anything with their earnings? Did they buy another company? Did they sell $1 billion worth of product? What would make that company go up 10 times in value? The answer is probably nothing. And so, sure enough, it was actually being driven by, I'll call it market greed or market demand. But that doesn't actually mean that the underlying value of the property, or in that case, the stock, had changed that much. And sure enough, when the market came back down again, a lot of those people lost money. So you have to think about houses which are not as liquid as a share of GameStop, where you can buy it and sell it multiple times in a day. A house is really what we call an illiquid investment. And so what the bank is trying to do is make sure that the underlying value is relative to all the other houses in the neighborhood.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. You can tell I'm not the one lending the money here. I just want somebody to be able to borrow more than maybe the intrinsic value of the house, whatever that means. By the way, GameStop, I'm just reading now from CNBC.com. Shares of the video game retailer GameStop continued its volatile trading on Monday, jumping nearly 40%. The company announced they got a new CEO. That former Chewy executive Ryan Cohen will lead a committee, pardon me, to shape GameStop's transition to e-commerce. I don't know what it's trading at today, but up and down, sometimes 40% in a day. I guess you would be conservative if you were lending people against the value of that stock, right? If it were a house, say. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. And I think you want to be happy about that as a buyer, because at the end of the day, if you can't qualify for your mortgage and you've let your excitement get away from you and you've bid maybe more than you can actually afford, which is the other thing that lenders have to be careful about, right? Having that backstop where the lender says, hey, you know, that's a great thing, but no, we're not going to let that go through. You can't really afford that. It's not so bad to have that as a backstop as well, especially if you're buying your first place.
What an interesting point. By the way, the Dow is now up 631 points. The Dow is up 631. International Women's Day. Do you have thoughts about that?
Well, of course, I think it's wonderful. We should have International Women's Week. But there have been a couple of really interesting surveys, one of which that I thought you'd be interested in, John. The National Association of Personal Financial Advisors came out with some new research that shows that women are facing greater financial challenges than men in the U.S., and a lot of this has to do with COVID. So we talked, I think, last week or the week before about how women have really borne the brunt of the job layoffs in the second half of last year, particularly in December, right? But for women in investing, which is what NAFTA really focuses on, women say, almost half of women say they wish that they had gone back in time, they would start an emergency fund or contribute more to their emergency fund, far more than men do. And women, 40%, are worried that they're not going to have enough money to retire comfortably versus less than 30% of men. And so women just have much more financial stress, and they really experience that financial stress in a very different way. And so the research that came out today, I think it's good to put a focus on that.
What advice do you have for women in that case?
You know, I think women need to be more confident about what they know, right? So a third of men say in the survey that they're really confident when it comes to investing, but fewer than 20% of women are confident. But I think women know more than they think they do. Women tend to be more thoughtful investors than men. Men are tend to be the water cooler investor. They always want something to brag about, whereas women tend to be very steady. They take less risk. They do better, though, in the long run. And I want women to trust that, that by being thoughtful and careful and doing their research, that they can be just fine when it comes to managing money, and even better than fine. And so I want to encourage all women this month to do one positive thing when it comes to their personal finances. Learn something new, take over the management of the checkbook or the checking account, go and put some money into an investment. You can do it. I just want to encourage everybody. And I can do it. You can do it.
I think we've all heard stories of women who, when their husband passes, say, I have no idea what we have or where it is. But my guess is that on the day-to-day finances, women are probably more involved in paying the bills and buying things for the household than the men.
Yes to the buying, no to the paying the bills. Really, a lot of men are the ones in the household that take over the responsibility for paying those bills, whereas women do more of the shopping and the buying. But the shopping and the buying is not quite the same thing as knowing where all of your money is and how it's invested. And I want women to go out this month and learn something about that.
Well, you could start by visiting Elise Glink's website then, thinkglink.com, the real estate and financial wellness expert. Elise, we'll talk next Monday. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you, John.
12:35 on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Pete Zimmerman's the producer. This is John Williams, 18 stories up, downtown Chicago, overlooking the Chicago River. No ice there. Blue skies overhead. The Dow is up 600. What was the last number that we just quoted there? 643 was the last number I saw. Don, that's about where it is.
Yeah, just about 621 right now.
And the NASDAQ is off. Was off 75 points or so last I looked.
Now 93 down.
Okay, we can live with all of that, I suppose. And I guess some of this is predicated on not only the good, continuing good coronavirus news, but also the imminent passing, it appears, of this stimulus bill. Let's talk a little bit about what's happening in Chicago now. Catherine Davis is an associate editor at Chicago Inno. Visit ChicagoInno.com. Hey, Catherine, thanks for joining us today. How are you?
Hi, John. I'm good. The sun's out. The temperatures are up. Don't have much to complain about today.
I wonder if, the relatively good economic news we have, forget about the long-term consequences of this, but there's a lot of good news about the economy, the coronavirus, and how the coronavirus affects the economy and markets. I wonder if that then also impacts venture capitalists, VC funding, the sorts of things that you all follow at Chicago Inno. Does that trickle down into your sector or sphere as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I think any positive news about the economy gets, you know, the private investors more interested in how, you know, they can get their money out to growing companies, whether it's here in Chicago, around the company, or even globally. You know, it's interesting because just in the last month or so, there's been a lot of venture capital news. You know, a lot of investors are coming out saying that they've raised new funds that, you know, are tens of millions, sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars. So it's really been interesting to see the activity in Chicago recently. There's just been so much of it.
Well, that's why I bring it up. And every now and then I ask you all that, or marvel at the fact that over the last 12 months, how much money you all do report on. Maybe it's less than it would have otherwise been, but people are still gambling on or investing in these all kinds of different foods, food delivery, tech firms, et cetera, in Chicago. And maybe it's even going to be more aggressive going forward.
Yeah, you know, one of the new funds that we covered last week is called Cleveland Avenue, and it's actually a food innovation-focused venture capital firm from the former McDonald's CEO, Don Thompson. You know, he launched Cleveland Avenue to sort of invest in underrepresented founders in Chicago, and this latest fund specifically focused on food innovation for Black, Latinx, and women entrepreneurs, and it's $70 million. So, you know, that's nothing to, you know, not make a big deal about. $70 million in Chicago can fund a lot of companies. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, where that money goes. They've already made a few investments to some local companies, 86 Repairs and some others. So we'll just, you know, kind of monitor how they deploy that capital going forward.
You wrote about a firm called Long Jump, right?
Yeah, so LongJump is also a new venture capital firm, but the different thing about them is that as opposed to being led by traditional investors, where that's sort of their full-time, you know, job, LongJump is actually founded by other Chicago startup founders. And so these are people that are actively leading and growing startups in Chicago right now. You know, if you're in the tech scene, there's some familiar names like the DraftBit COO, Tim Grace, and the Paladin co-founder and CEO, Kristen Sunday. And, you know, a few other people have come together, and this fund launched last week. And, the ethos is to write checks ranging from $50,000 to $100,000. So these are, you know, early stage checks, sort of that friends and family round. But, you know, the idea is to invest in the next generation of Chicago tech entrepreneurs.
What does Workbox do?
Yeah, so Workbox is a cool company because, you know, I'm sure that you're aware of co-working companies like a WeWork or an Industrious. And Workbox has a lot of those similar elements in the sense that it's a workspace for small businesses to come, and sort of do the day-to-day operations. But in addition to providing office space, Workbox is also providing an accelerator program to its members. So, you know, they're giving mentoring, access to capital, and, you know, sort of different business growth resources that, you know, are in a sense more helpful than just the traditional co-working space could be.
But that's interesting because I thought the beauty of those co-working spaces was that they were streamlined, that they had lower costs going in, you had lower costs. If you expand services, maybe that's a niche in the market or a niche, but then again, be careful what you ask for because then maybe you're going to incur more costs and maybe it's not so streamlined anymore.
Yeah, you know, Workbox memberships right now, they range anywhere from $200 to $800 per month. So, you know, depending on your WeWork membership, I think it's sort of comparable. But the interesting thing about Workbox is that the idea seems to be catching on because they're opening two new locations this spring, one in the Gold Coast and one in River North. Their first location is in the Loop. So, you know, people are liking this. They also offer a remote model. So, you know, even if you didn't want to go into the co-working office every day, you could still get the sort of business growth resources from home or remotely.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of resources, just tell us a little bit about EdTech then.
Yeah, so there was some interesting education tech activity last week. GSV Ventures is an education tech-focused venture capital firm. They're based here and in San Francisco, but they closed the second fund at $180 million last week. So I don't know if you're familiar with MasterClass, John, but you know, if you've seen their commercials, but they're, you know, sort of video tutorials on certain topics by, you know, really interesting people like Shonda Rhimes and RuPaul and a lot of other interesting sort of celebrities and high profile people. And that's one of the companies that GSV is actually invested in. And so they've raised this new fund to continue investing in those sort of companies as well.
Yeah, a couple of us here at WGN Radio have MasterClass memberships. Kevin Powell in the afternoon, does sports on the Chicago's Afternoon News, is into that big time. And I forget what it is.
Okay.
He did the entire series on one of the classes, and it wasn't steak cooking, which is you know, because he's always sharing pictures on social media of the food he's eating and preparing, and it wasn't sports. I forget what it was, but it was sort of a little bit out of his box, but that's what MasterClass enables you to do, is learn from a master. It's something maybe a little outside of your zone. So what an interesting space to be in, right?
Absolutely.
All right, we are out of time. Let's visit again next week. Thanks for helping us out today, and we'll talk to you next Monday, Catherine.
All right, thanks, John.
Catherine Davis is the associate editor at Chicago Inno. The business news continues now on the Wintrust Business Lunch. This is Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. A health tech startup from Southern California is moving its headquarters to Chicago. Solved Health is moving its HQ into a life sciences research facility in Lincoln Park. The company will take space at the Stanley Mann Research Institute at 2430 North Halsted. Solved is the maker of two devices, including one that assesses a patient's risk of opioid addiction before treatment is prescribed. The other aims to prevent colon cancer by detecting precancerous polyps as well as early-stage carcinomas. Crane's report Solved has 100 full-time employees, but it's unclear how many will move to Chicago. New stats show O'Hare Airport had the lightest traffic in more than 50 years last year. The Chicago Department of Aviation says the number of passengers flying to or from O'Hare fell 64%, with just 30.9 million passengers. That figure was 84.6 million in 2019. It's a trend other airports saw as well. Washington Reagan National fell 69%, Atlanta Hartsfield-Jackson fell 61%, and Dallas-Fort Worth fell 48%. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
The markets are doing well. I know Bob Surratt will talk about some of that tomorrow morning. He'll also, I hear, be talking about the fact that Twitter has an undo option, but let's start telling you about that right now with Amy Guth. Amy, what are you hearing about this innovation on Twitter?
Yeah, I think a lot of people are very excited about this because, you know, you send a tweet and you realize you've made a typo and you're like, oh, I got to delete it and redo it just for this one thing. Essentially, it's going to work how I know in Gmail has a similar feature where for a very limited time, you can reopen the tweet, kind of undo it, fix whatever you need to do, and then send it off. So it will show underneath the words your tweet was sent. So you'll have this little window where you can kind of adjust something in your tweet. So it won't be long. And you just have this tiny window to correct a typo or I don't know if someone wants to maybe like send a rage tweet about their boss or something, they could maybe take that down if they're like, maybe that's not a good idea, things like that. So it kind of helps for that. A lot of users are saying that's one step, but what we're really looking for is an edit button. So, but I think it's a lot of people on Twitter are talking about this in terms of what that could mean for tweets. I mean, we've all been there. You send something and you know you make a typo in it and you have to take it down really quick and hope no one retweets it before you do, or you realize you know you've made a mistake in it or something like that and you need to correct that. So I think it's going to be really interesting for that purpose. I think for, you know, there's, of course, a million questions with that edit button that I think people are really, really kind of gunning for of what that means, because sometimes, you know, what's in a tweet is on the record. So especially like a public official could tweet something. And if there's an option to edit it, what does that mean for them and what they've said on the record, things like that. So I think there's a lot of questions to be answered before we would get a full on edit button that would go on and on. But for now, you're able to correct typos and you have this little window.
I don't know why Twitter is so hesitant to give people an edit function. You have it on Facebook. Why? You have it on all kinds of platforms. You have it on Microsoft Word. Not that that's a platform, but why don't you have an edit button on Twitter? Because yeah. Well, you're right. I've done this. I've done some masterful tweets. And then I look at it and go, oh, crap. So I'm either going to live with that or I'm going to take it down and do the whole thing all over again. Why can't I just cursor over to the mistake and make that I a T? You know what I mean?
Right, exactly. And that's exactly kind of what they're working on. We'll see what demand does for that. For, you know, I think what their effort is here, and this is just kind of my interpretation, but the game of this is perhaps just how many of the people that are asking for that edit button are in fact really just saying, I need to fix a typo, versus people that would be wanting to really change the tone of what they were trying to say, like yeah. A public official, and then it becomes a thing. I mean, as tweets are archived and on the record, I think that does really pose some questions for what an edit button would mean. But the short-term one, I'm a fan because I make typos in tweets all the time.
I think the point you were making before that, though, is interesting, and it's something that maybe I'll look into more, at least philosophically, this week.
Yeah.
If I undo a tweet, do I undo the tweet? Like if you put it out on Twitter, it's digital, it's permanent. And that said something about where you were at that point in time. Now you can go back and subtract it if you want, but that maybe doesn't change. First of all, people will screen grab it anyway.
Maybe yeah, that's does, right.
Maybe there's no tweeting back, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, a lot of times people will, you'll hear about a famous person saying something controversial on Twitter, and then maybe after some backlash, they'll take the tweet down.
Yeah, like that fixes it, right?
Yeah, right. But meanwhile, a million people have screen grabbed it and sent it all around the world. So who knows what exactly that would mean? I agree with you. I think there's like a philosophical piece of it, of what an edit button would mean if you think about, say, the president being able to say something and then edit a tweet that says something substantially different. I think that does pose some philosophical questions that Twitter's going to have to think through.
And maybe politicians should be treated differently, as they are people of public policy.
That's right.
What is this story about buying the first tweet?
Okay, this one can get you down a rabbit hole really quickly. But Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey is selling the first ever published tweet as an NFT. And an NFT, there's a wonderful explainer on The Verge, which is a great tech reporting site, about what an NFT is. It's you know, it's kind of along the lines of, like, if you think of cryptocurrency and blockchain, you have this kind of shareable information. This is the opposite of that. It's still kind of in that realm, but it's unshareable. So it would be kind of this one person could own this information sort of thing, but it means a non-fungible token. And the tweet is Jack Dorsey's first tweet. It's him saying, just setting up my Twitter, and he spells it T-W-T-T-R. So maybe he needs that edit button, but that's the tweet. That's the first ever tweet that was sent on Twitter. The bids, though, you know, when I saw that was going to be an option, I thought, well, who would want that? That's kind of a weird thing. Some technologists will probably just think that's funny and pay 10 or 20 bucks for it. No, the current bid is $2.5 million for that, which is kind of difficult to even wrap your head around, that somebody would, you know, have $2.5 million laying around and think, well, this is a good idea. This is what I want, right?
But indeed, for a concept, it's not even a thing.
That's right. It's not really even a thing. I was thinking about how I would explain NFTs in our conversation, like how I can say that is most succinctly. It's a concept. It's not a thing at all. So it's really difficult. That's why everybody should head to this on The Verge, this really interesting explainer that's more than you ever wanted to know about NFTs. But you're left at the end of it still going, well, it's not even really a thing. It's just a concept. And that someone would pay $2.5 million for a concept. That's a new one. But here we are.
30 seconds, Amy. Give me what jumps out at you on the White Sox and the Cubs today.
Well, you know, I think so much about revenue. You know, we still have the Bulls, and the hockey teams are still playing to empty stadiums. And here's an outdoor venue that the Sox and Cubs are going to have 20% capacity. The city has lifted that, the 20% capacity on opening day. Of course, that may change as the season goes on. We'll see so many games. But I think just in terms of revenue, of what that's going to do for the teams, that's so significant for them. And I think for a lot of people who, at this time last year, at the beginning of the pandemic, things became very real when sports started to make really hard decisions. So this is probably kind of a sign of normalcy to come for a lot of sports fans.
First home game for the Cubs is the 1st of April, and for the Sox a week later on the 8th. So 20%, you got to wear the mask. And that's good news. We'll talk to you again later. Thanks, Amy.
Thanks so much, John.